call a meeting to order now that we have some members here, besides myself. I think I'll move to House Law 675. Ms. Heegard, would you and Mr. Michikanis come forward and you can present my bill. And I would move that House File 675 be recommended to pass and held over for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Higher Education and Workforce Development Bill. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair and members, thank you. I'm Susan Heegard with the Minnesota Office of the Higher Education, and I'm joined by Mark Michikanis with the Office of Higher Education as well.
Welcome.
Can I ask you, Mr. Chair, how would you like us to proceed? Our understanding, though, was that you wanted us to just speak to the financial aid and achieve, but are you wanting us to move through the whole bill? I'm not clear about that.
No, I think that would be appropriate. We've had a number of discussions about, you know, a lot of your budget and your budget requests already, and I think that's what you want to emphasize, so you go ahead and handle my bill for me.
Let's speak first then, Mr. Chair, if you're amenable to this, to the financial aid aspect of the bill. Do you want us to talk about the GI Bill also? Is that...
You can talk about state grants, the GI Bill, the ACHIEVE, whatever other little items are in there that you want to emphasize.
Okay, thank you.
America. Freedom of speech.
Mr. Chair and members, for the record, I'm Mark Michikanis with the Office of Education. Let me start speaking to initially the state grant proposals in the bill. And if you prefer, I can point them out in the bill language themselves. But generally speaking, the state grant has a base appropriation. It's a fixed appropriation. And this is not a quote forecasted program. So it is fixed from year to year unless you make policy changes in it and add appropriations to it. So reflecting those changes, the base is about $145 million a year. We also get about $1.2 million from the federal government in a couple programs called LEAP and SLEEP that we can use for the same purposes. For a number of reasons, the program has been understanding that appropriation, so there's available funds within the base appropriation to be redirected to parameter changes. This is what the governor is recommending, is three changes. In order to spend that money, he's also added $12 million in the biennium, about $6 million a year, to that base number, increasing it to roughly $151 million. There are we had three changes initially that you see in this bill, Mr. Chair, but there is a fourth change that came out in the supplemental. So let me speak to the first three because you have language in front, then I'll talk about the fourth one.
Go ahead.
The first two changes appear on page 3 of the bill. It's in rider language under the state grant appropriation. There is a tuition and fee maximum that applies to private institutions, but also the University of Minnesota is up against that maximum now as well. The current level set 2 years ago was $9,438 annually. The bill and the governor's recommendation would raise that by $400 to $9,838. The cost of that is roughly $5.7 million a year. The second change, and that's on line 17 and 19, that's both for 4-year and 2-year institutions, by the way. The second change is on page 3, it's line 22. The living and miscellaneous expense allowance, again, is something that's fixed by the legislature every 2 years. The current level is $5,350. Again, that's 2 years ago. The recommendation would increase that by $200. And the cost of that is roughly $6 million a year, a little bit more the second year.
Mr. Cass, the new money and the state grant program is basically eaten up with the tuition, moving the caps up, and with the living allowance.
Those are two of the three changes, Mr. Chair. There's a third one that's a bit later in the bill, in the rider and the statutory language.
Could you just point that out now, then?
Yes, Mr. Chair. If I can find it quickly, it is on page 17, section 11, assigned family responsibility. And I think we may have made this point in previous hearings, but this family responsibility is based on the federal need analysis. if you have college children, you fill out a FAFSA probably. It comes out of that analysis. As part of that that federal need analysis, there's a what I call a tax rate, the tax structure. Think about in terms of income tax, it's exactly structured the same way with very, very substantial marginal tax rates. At the top end, it's about 47% on a family income of about $65,000. So it's dramatically different from income tax rates. And what we're trying to do is to mitigate that a bit, is to kind of lessen the progressive nature of that tax rate. And that's the language that's in that section. And that,
but Mr. Michikanis, if I can, you're trying to make it more regressive?
No, more regressive. No, less progressive. Less progressive.
Is that the same as more regressive on the IRA?
Right. It kind of depends on what income you're looking at. I think between $30,000 and $65,000 to make it less progressive.
Mm-hmm. And the cost of that is?
That cost of that is roughly $6 million a year as well.
So let's just looking at this here on the max, lifting the private maximum to the university's 98.38, which I assume that is. I don't know where the 68.36 comes from. And the living expenses, the total cost of those, we'll call them three, is...
Well, three changes, I think, about $18 million.
So the governor puts in $12 million, but he makes changes that cost $18.
Just because of other savings in the program.
Right, but where am I supposed to find that? Because it's $6 million, can I?
Mr. It's already in the base number, the $145 million. So that was the starting point that we worked from because it was part of the base.
It's the difference, Mr. Chair, between the appropriation and what has been spent. That's one chunk of the money that we're looking at. And then the governor's added.
This is continuing, of course, so it's in the base. But what you're doing is spending some of the money that he put up that he's saying that he's increasing money for higher education while it's covering. The cost of it is more than what he actually put in the state grant program, right?
I think that's correct, Mr. Chair, but he has only talked about the $12 million of additional money above the base. I don't think any of the documents of the Department of Finance speak more than that as far as...
Right, I'm just trying to clarify things in my own mind. Okay.
The last change that Mr. Chair, members, Congress enacted a continuing federal resolution a few weeks back. The President signed it, and it changed the Pell Grant, increased it by $460 per person. The way the state grant works, it actually saves us on the state side, roughly $10.5 to $11 million a year. In supplemental budget, the governor recommended reinvesting that money, if you will, back into the program by reducing the student share from the current 46% to 45.5%. So again, it's not new money needed out of a budget, but it is money that's kind of part of the state grant base.
So you guys want to spend that, and I had ideas on how to spend that, but that little tweak of a half percentage point on that student's, what does that cost annually?
A percent and a half is about $10.5 million a year.
That's another $10.5 million, guys. You guys are shuffling around money. Okay.
Mr. Chair, we've shared documents with more detail with Mr. Burke, so he has seen those as well.
I've got him keeping an eye on you, guys. Keep going.
Thank you.
Let's talk about on the GI Bill next, Mr. Chair. Let's talk about Achieve. That's Article 3 on page 25 of the bill. And I think I've spoken on this issue to you before in committee when we've been going through the bill, but this is basically the governor's revised proposal on the Achieve plan. His first proposal had been to reward students in the top 25% of their graduating class with free, basically, tuition. He revised that proposal now to focus on rewarding low and moderate income students for taking college-level courses while in high school. The student would be able to earn $314 a course. They would be able to earn the equivalent, you know, possibly of as much year of college credit while they're in high school. The scholarships would be paid once the student graduates from high school. They would be able to get the money that they built up in an account overseen by our office, and they could use that at the college of their choice. We built the program on top of existing programs like post-secondary enrollment options, college in the schools, concurrent enrollment programs, AP and IB. And I know, Mr. Chair, you've expressed some concern about access in greater Minnesota. That's one of the things that we also share a concern about. And I think critical to making a program like this successful is making sure that there's good access across the board for students. There's $92 million for this program. It's $46 million a year, and the program money would be available for the students for 4 years after they graduate.
And
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, we changed that to 39. We had an error, and we changed that overall cost to $39 million, so it's $78 million for the biennium.
The 92 has become 78.
And the supplemental that was changed.
Mr. Chair, there was an error. We put the bill originally together back in January about how the students were counted, given the other parameters in the bill. And the cost under the bill as it's structured now is really $39 million a year, not 46.
Go ahead.
Okay. And it would be eligible to students from families of $100,000 or less. I think the governor's initial proposal had gone much higher up on the income scale. This is $100,000 or less, so it would be available to low and moderate income students and their families. The next thing that I'd like to talk about is the Minnesota GI Bill. That is a proposal that would cost $30 million, $15 million roughly a year. We've been working on this bill for quite some time. If you look at veterans, the benefits are fairly uneven among different kinds of veterans. And the attempt of this bill, I think, is to try to provide some more evenness for veterans, regardless of where they came from in the armed forces. It would be available to veterans and their spouses and children of 100% disabled or diseased veterans.
Where's the language? What page again is that?
Sorry, page 27 and page 28. What we've done is we built the program on top of existing financial aid programs, so those programs, Mr. Chair and members, would come first. This program would pay after that. What's available to the student, the individual veteran, would be $1,000 a term, a maximum of $1,000 a term, $3,000 a year, a $10,000 maximum.
Hagar?
Yes.
If you recall, I think I might have mentioned this to you or maybe someone else on your staff about the, I saw something that was sad in the paper here a few weeks ago about that. I think there's been like 13 suicides related to Iraqi soldiers that have come back. Would they qualify under your language, their children then, on the language on 28.8, or would that have to be an interpretation by Office of Higher Education?
My understanding, Mr. Chair, is that if a person is deceased, if there's a deceased veteran, or if there's a person who's 100% disabled, they would qualify under the program. That's my understanding.
Would a suicide that occurred after that, for whatever reasons, and there's a lot of veterans that aren't being taken care of, would that be considered a direct result of military service?
You know, Mr. Chair, I don't believe so. We're just checking the language right now. I mean, that's certainly something we'd be willing to work with you on. But my understanding, Mr. Michikanis is taking a look right now, is that the person would have had to have passed away during active duty. Is that correct?
Would you consider that the Representative Detmer probably might want to jump in on this, but I think it's a point to be considered if we move ahead with this program.
I think, Mr. Chair, we're willing to work with you on this if that's an interest that members have.
Yeah, Mr. Chair.
Detmer, do you
have a comment? This came up at the, I'm on the Veterans Affairs Committee, and it's a good question, Mr. Chairman, so yeah, we would definitely like to look at that question.
Mr. Chair, the way their language reads on page 29 is that the veteran died as a direct result of that military service. I guess that's open to interpretation on the relationship between the two.
Well, maybe we can make it more clear. Okay, I'm sorry. I just wanted to. bring that point up. Go ahead, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. We'll look into that. There were several other programs, Mr. Chair, smaller programs in the bill that I wanted to just draw your attention to. Let's see, we've gone through the state grant, the GI Bill, and the Achieve Scholarship. We've got $2 million in the bill for tuition reciprocity. I don't know if I have the page. Where is that? The $2 million is to deal with an obligation that we have to North Dakota. We've had an increase in participation there, and basically the states just threw up at the end of the year, and we owe North Dakota this time around $2 million. There's also an appropriation for the Learning Network of $1.15 million, $575,000 each year. That's to support increased access to education across Minnesota. As you know, there's a lot of more online course taking that's occurring, and it allows for the bandwidth to be increased up to the door of the institution. And then there's some language, et cetera, in the bill. I don't know if you would like for us to go through language that's not funding related, but we'd be happy to cover some of those things. I don't know what the time restriction is today, but we were told the committee particularly wanted to hear about the Achieve Bill and state grant programs.
I think, does anyone have any questions related to language changes? Representative Moe.
Madam Chair, just if there are any language changes specific that you would like us to know about that we haven't covered in the bill.
Madam Chair, there is one other financial aspect I should perhaps raise.
Okay,
this
go has ahead.
To do with the 529 savings plan. It's on page 24 of the bill, section 32. Currently, there's a roughly $1 million appropriation in the base for the savings plan. We've been understanding that for a number of years. This is matching money for people up to $80,000 of income when they contribute to a 529 plan. Because it's been underspent, we're recommending some changes in those parameters, increasing a maximum from $300 to $400, and then changing the percentage for people making between $50,000 and $80,000 from 5 to 10%. That would spend another $350,000 a year. That's within the current appropriation base level, so against that base, there's no additional request for additional funding.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, Representative Moe, there is language in this bill about...
Could you first just identify yourself? I'm sorry.
Yes. I'm sorry. Tricia Grimes on the Office of Higher Education Staff. Sorry. There is language in the first few sections of Article 2 that has to do with repealing the enrollment adjustment for Minnesota and University of Minnesota and their base budgets. When legislature repealed the enrollment adjustment in 2005, the agency was mandated to do a study. We gathered representatives of the systems together and came out with a report, and these pieces of language would implement that report. If you have further questions about that, Mr. Buchanan may want to go into that. In addition, in Article 1, Section 2, Subdivision 19, in the front of the bill, there is language that would give the agency permission to do a study of state grant recipients and, in conjunction with our enrollment record database, match data from the two databases, to do a study of participation by income, persistence by different students in different income groups, and graduation rates. And that may not sound like rocket science, but we have previously been told by our attorney not to match the data from those two databases, so if the legislature gives us the permission to do so, we would be able to conduct that kind of study. In Article 2, Sections 10 and 15 are about what institutions are eligible to participate in the state grant and self-loan programs. This would say that beginning in fiscal year 2012, all private institutions would have to be participating in the federal Pell Grant program in order to participate in the state grant program. Currently, we have some institutions that are not participating in the federal Pell Grant program. Then, in Article 2, Section 12, is some language about the treatment of incarcerated students. Now, sorry if this is a little complicated, but I'll try to go through it step by step. When we first established the language that's in the bill currently, not the underlying portion, incarcerated individuals who are going to school were eligible for federal Pell Grants. And we generally subtract the Pell Grant as part of our calculation. We figure out what the price of dependence is and what the assigned family responsibility is. And then we do all that subtraction. One of the things we subtract is the federal Pell Grant that student is eligible for. In order to get the most mileage out of the federal Pell Grant, we kind of leverage it with the state grant on top of that. Along the way, Congress made incarcerated students ineligible for Pell Grants, but we have continued to subtract the Pell Grant in our state grant calculation as if they were eligible. The end result of this is that very few incarcerated students receive state grants. In other words, we do not actually have clear legislative authority to continue the practice that we are currently doing. So we are requesting that authority. If the legislature in its wisdom wanted us to give more state grants to incarcerated students, we would also need the authority, clear authority, to do that. Right now, we don't have clear authority either way.
Mr. Chairman, so correct me if I'm wrong then. You're asking us for authority to subtract the federal grant in your calculation, even if they're not receiving it, and you want authority to continue to do that, thus making it more difficult for incarcerated students to get state grants.
Yes.
Representative Conklin.
Thank you. Are we talking about bachelor's degrees and associate of arts degrees for kids in college? Are we talking about job training?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gunther, this could be anything at the undergraduate level, including job training. It would have to be something they could study while incarcerated. Generally speaking, they are not allowed to use the Internet while incarcerated, so that it tends to be correspondence courses or courses that are brought to the institution in which they are incarcerated. The language that we're talking about having would continue the practice that we currently do.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, one thing, when somebody that's incarcerated gets out of being incarcerated, prison or wherever, they have no abilities to succeed. They have no place to go but where they came from. They have no thing to do except go back to the environment that they offended in. And if we could do some ability, aptitude, and interest testing in the prison, on the prisoners, on a voluntary basis, I don't think we want to mandate that, but if they're interested in getting some job skills for a job that they have an ability, aptitude, and interest in, I think we'll be serving the state very well, because I think the chances of them reoffending if they go out with the prospect of getting a job and becoming a taxpayer is much better than sending back to the same environment that they came to prison from. And I think fiscal analysts should absolutely give us a positive number there. Even though short-term cost, long-term gain, nothing makes our society work better than those rings in the cash register in the Department of Revenue called taxes. So I think it's something that we should consider developing a program for specific job training to give them skills to have specific jobs that they have ability, aptitude, and interest in.
Representative Gunther, yesterday, if you recall, the OIC program and the young gentleman that sat right over, right just a little to the my left of Mr. Michikanis, and he talked about his seven-time felony, and he was a very polite gentleman who had turned his life around, and that state program allowed him to move on with his life, and now he's earning an income and everything else. And I think I share your concern and Representative Moe's concern, and as we put our bill together, we'll look at some language that maybe works for the both of you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, if I could just have two little additional explanatory comments. It's not that the agency is against education for incarcerated students. What we're looking for is language to authorize us to do one thing or the other.
We understand that you have this federal problem, which I thought was absurd also, because, you know, I mean, I think they're disqualified for minor drug offenses, some students, so. But
there is another portion of statute, Mr. Chairman, that says that incarcerated students may not receive a living and miscellaneous expense allowance since the taxpayers are already paying for their living expenses. That provision also makes it much less likely that a student who is incarcerated will receive a grant.
Well, I think if they're incarcerated, they're probably getting living expenses already and maintenance. Representative Nornes.
Mr. Chair, I was just thinking when you're talking about training, I think the one program that the state does have that really accomplishes some of this is the Sentence to Serve program. There are a lot of incarcerated that get a chance to go out and do some building and some good learning some job skills through that program. I like to see more of that, but we really benefited that greatly in some of our state parks and so forth.
Representative Moe.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We could back up a little bit. You said you were appealing the enrollment adjustment. I wonder if you could talk a little bit more about that and how that might impact the allocation to these different institutions.
Mr. Chair, perhaps I can speak. That the enrollment adjustment actually was repealed 2 years ago. So that's been gone from the statute since that time. We were directed to do a study about related to that, and we've had a task force that met 2 years ago. Mr. Fitzenreiter, Ms. Tonneson from the university were there, Ms. King and Ms. Borden from Minsky were there, as well as actually Pam Wheelock served on that group, the legislative auditor. In any event, came up with a set of recommendations that included cleaning up some of the language that since the enrollment adjustment was no longer there, doing that was one aspect of it. There was a discussion about the policy statement in law regarding the 67%. What the report recommended was repealing that statement, but suggested a conversation about a different kind of policy statement. The issue with the University of Minnesota is different than Minsky. The university is less interested in the enrollment adjustment because their focus is so much on research. So they wanted something that kind of dealt with that as well, which is not in that policy statement. So that was part of that conversation. So the language you have in front of you is essentially what came out of that report. It was in last year's bill, too, but never was enacted.
Representative Detmer.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman. I apologize, but let's go back to the section on Minnesota GI program, GI Bill. Page 29. I'm trying to remember what we did in the Veterans Affairs Committee. Maybe you can help me here. In terms of eligibility, line 29-34, person described in clause 1 item, had Minnesota has the person's state of residence at the time of the person's initial enlistment or any reenlistment in the United States Armed Forces. I think I asked this question back in Veterans Affairs. What if somebody enlisted in Texas, now came off active duty, now is in the National Guard or Reserve here in Minnesota, lives in Minnesota, would he be eligible under this bill?
Mr. Cannon.
Mr. Chair, I don't believe he would be. I'm not sure. I have to
admit that. If I could, Representative Emery, I think there's some recommendations coming from Veterans Affairs Committee that probably have addressed this. So we can address this as
okay.
We mark up the
bill. I think we did address an amendment there.
We've got a number of other bills, and we've heard most of this bill, and now we've looked at all the financial aspects of it. Unless you have anything else, members, or those of you at the table that you want to emphasize,
we're just about done, Mr. Church.
Okay.
Two things. Yes, if there are other changes and things in terms of the GI Bill, we'd be happy to work with you on those. And then I think Mr. Candace wanted to make sure that he talked just briefly about the college savings plan.
Briefly, Mr.
Chair, I did speak to that a bit earlier on the math. I did want to just raise the committee's attention. This is on page 20, starts on the bottom of page 19. It has to do with our self-loan program. It would authorize us to enter into an investment device called an interest rate swap. This is a significant program. The self-loan has assets, gross assets of nearly $900 million. At times we invest around $140 million in short-term investments. This would allow us to manage our risk a bit better. We do have financial advisors to help us think through these things wisely. Housing finance currently has this authority. In fact, this is almost exactly the same language. They're getting more limited to theirs. So we're seeking that authorization.
Are you booking a savings on this?
Mr. Chair, no, not at this time. Our sense is to get the authority from you and then take small steps to try to learn how it would work.
Okay. We'll consider it. And if anybody has any questions on that particular or part of the bill, they can get back to you all. And with that, thank you very much. And the bill is laid over for possible inclusion. Representative Atkins, House File 1142. Representative Atkins.
I'll move this for potential inclusion, Mr. Chair.
Okay, so move. Go ahead, Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The folks, we've heard lots and lots of good bills over the course of the semester, or whatever we call this, that are primarily talking about money that's going to institutions. In the just a recent bill that we heard a few minutes ago, we finally started the discussion about grants and aids that are available directly to students. And my bill hones it down even further. This bill is all about students and the funds that are available directly to students. Specifically, what it does, excuse me, is that it decreases the amount of the student share. Currently, that's pegged at about 46 or at 46%. It reduces it to 40. Recognizing that as tuition costs have continued to go up, we're fencing more and more students out. Secondly, is it's pegged to the University of Minnesota's costs. As you know, we've set it in, we cast a figure in the statute that we have to continually come back and adjust. And frankly, folks, it just simply hasn't kept up. This isn't pegged to the most expensive institution in Minnesota. It's not pegged to the least. It's our landmark institution in Minnesota is the University of Minnesota, and that seemed like a good driver of what the state grant program should allocate. And by the way, there's a misunderstanding sometimes about the state grant program. Some folks think it's mostly aimed at certain affluent students, or that they can somehow get more. The fact is, it's mostly low and middle income students. About two-thirds goes to public kids going to public college or public institutions, with one-third going to privates. The additional thing that it does, and what I am a true believer in, is that it increases the maximum amount that's available for child care. Standing in between a number of students and their ability to better themselves and achieve an education that will allow them to make a good living is the fact that they got a real life going on here, folks. They've got kids, they're working, they're doing a lot of different things. And the amount that's currently eligible for child care and other expenses just simply hasn't kept up either. And so it adjusts those figures. With me today is David Laird, who would be and has a few minutes of testimony, and then we'd be happy to stand for your questions or maybe others. I know that we've got some nice young folks here as well that have been finding me all day telling me how necessary this bill is. And with that, I appreciate your support and introduce Mr. Laird.
Thank you. Mr. Laird, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's good to be with you. My name is David Laird. I'm the president of the Minnesota Private College Council, and appreciate the opportunity to talk with you about this specific bill. The state grant program, as we heard earlier, is a program which was inaugurated in 1967. It's been sustained over all these years by bipartisan support in both houses. As Representative Atkins just said, this is a program for students and their families, so that they can determine which programs, which institutions, which parts of the state best fit their needs and their abilities. It's not a program for institutions. Right now, this program affects 1 out of 4 Minnesota resident students in all of post-secondary education in Minnesota. That's roughly 71,000 students. The program is in our judgment and the judgment of less biased people, the most efficient way to target scarce public resources to students with demonstrated need. The changes in the bill, as Representative Atkins has already identified, are designed to respond to the urgent needs of middle-income students who are just above the cusp of eligibility in the current program, and lowest-income students who are in a situation in which every time their tuition goes up, they have to borrow more. And if you'd look in your packets that that are in your before your desk, there's a sheet that the front of the sheet is looks like this, and the back of the sheet has a graphic which describes to you what we think is a crisis situation. Last year, students and their families in all of the higher education groups in Minnesota broke through the $1 billion mark in borrowing. That's not something to be celebrated, and it will have impacts for as long as we can see forward. Many of them are looking at borrowing costs and repayment schemes that are going to take them well into their middle ages and well into the point at which they really ought to be starting to save for their children's higher education. That graphic shows a 15-year disruption in what has been intended to be a three-legged stool, with the federal government providing the basic support for access, the state providing for additional support for access and choice, and institutions filling in the gaps that families cannot afford. Well, if you look at that bar graph and think about that $1 billion worth of borrowing last year, that suggests to us that families are over the barrel and are borrowing far too much by themselves and on the part of their children. And both federal and state governments need to step in and help make up that difference. In fact, over the past 5 years, the net effect of the inability of federal and state resources to fill those gaps has resulted in a 14% drop in the effective purchasing power of the combination of the Pell Grant and the state grant. We'd add just one other point to our testimony here. We hear a lot about our foreign competition. We're hearing more about the fact that in the very near future, as the baby boomers retire, we're going to need to accelerate our production of college graduates. We're right now producing a level of college graduates in this state that will only meet half of the retirements that are going to occur in the next 10 years on an annual basis. So we'd nearly need to double our production of college graduates during the next decade. This would be a step to assist in bringing more students through high school into college and helping them succeed. The competition internationally is not waiting for us to decide whether or not we're going to take those strategic investments. They are indeed investing themselves. While we're working on things like this bill, the Chinese have authorized the development of 800 new institutions, new universities, within the next decade. That's the difference, and that's our competition. Be happy to stand for questions and to elaborate on anything we've said. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Laird. You know, I guess I've been rather saddened by the students who have come in front of this committee. The first month we had hearings and listened to them talk about the debt that we've helped them incur. You know, you get what you pay for, and when you convince at least segments of society that taxes are evil, and then you don't have any tax money to put into these programs, the result is that nice-looking colored graph that you showed us here for the audience. That red bar is the debt increase, and that's what happens. Mr. Laird, I noticed in your packet you have a letter or a statement of support from the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, and I'm wondering if they gave you any advice on how we should raise the... You know, I mean, I got to commend Representative Atkins. He's coming in front of the, you know, the committee with some real money now. And, you know, $90 million a year is, well, actually almost $100 million in a second year. You know, I think that's about maybe most of the money the Senate got for their entire higher education bill. So, Mr. Laird, where would you tell us to get this new money from?
Mr. Chairman.
If you were me.
If I were in your seat?
If you want to be this short, tell me what the... and you want to be me for a day, tell me what you'd do.
Mr. Chairman, when I first started testifying before this committee, I had a full head of hair. And
I was 6 feet tall. When I came here.
And,
in my own mind, anyhow.
And times were different then. But over the years, this has been a very high priority for legislators from both sides of the aisle in both houses, and it really hasn't mattered who's been in the chair. The question you're posing to me is, what kind of a priority is this? And if we have to find additional resources for this kind of priority, do we find them in additional revenues, or do we look into the base budgets and reprioritize what's there? And I think our judgment would be it has to be a combination.
Well, that doesn't help me much because, Claire, I think we've looked into the base budget in the last about, was it 3 or 4 years ago when the base, Mr. Berg helped me out, was cut by
$380 million
in our public institutions, an actual cut of that amount. And so I think, you know, we've kind of got to the bone in higher education, and I don't know what more reallocating we can do. But
Mr. Chairman, I don't want to equivocate here. If the only answer is to raise additional revenues in order to meet a priority like this, you would have our support to do that.
Thank you, Mr. Blair. You're being honest. Are you speaking for the chamber or yourself?
I didn't bring a proxy from them. So.
Would the chamber like to weigh in on that statement there? Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Stacia Smith with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. We feel it's very important to focus on improving our workforce, as David Laird so clearly expressed the need and the shortage that we're going to be feeling in the future. The Minnesota Chamber does feel that it's important to live within the budget, and we do not support increasing taxes and think that the existing budget, the $34 billion that we have, is sufficient to finance the state priorities.
Thank you, Ms. Smith. It's easy to say support a program that costs $190 million and not find the money to do it. I don't know how we reallocate and keep reallocating the same money when we've just heard from our fiscal analyst that we actually cut $350 some million out of our institutions recently. Ms. Representative Hartman, to the witness or to Mr. Laird? Or?
Just a comment on this conversation, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
We
it's America. For the flag and everything else. Go ahead.
We all are talking about raising taxes as though it's something that this body has not done recently, the House of Representatives or the legislature, and I just think that we need to remember in 2005, 2006, the K-12 finance budget bill had $139 million worth of property tax increases. And every single Republican, except for Dan Dorman and maybe one other, voted for that bill out of the House and voted for that bill when it came back from conference. And so, you know, this year, Representative Greiling has proposed looking at an income tax increase. And from what I know, the income tax increase she's proposed, it's not a wildly different amount of money than what we did with the property tax increase in 2005. In addition, there were fees upon fees upon fees that we increased. So when we're having this conversation about what tax do we want to raise to pay for an educational program, let's not pretend we didn't just do this. We did do this. The question is not whether we're willing to raise taxes to fund education, because most people in this room have already done that. The question is, if we're going to do that, which tax should we raise? And I think the place where Democrats are a little different on that than Republicans is we're not so inclined to just put it on the property tax bill and then say we didn't raise taxes.
Well, thank you, Representative Hartman and Ms. Smith. You know, the business owners on my main streets in the communities I represent were down, ironically, I think it was yesterday. And, you know, their property taxes have escalated, as you alluded to, and to the tune of in this state $2.2 billion in the last 3 years as a direct result of what we've done at the Capitol, I think. So, you know, it's just, you know, my old friend Rugby Poponi on the Virginia City Council always used to say that his Italian immigrant father used to say the only good taxes are the ones your neighbor pays. And that seems to be the case. But
I don't remember the Chamber of Commerce telling us not to vote for the K-12 finance bill in 2005 because it had $139 million worth of property taxes in it.
Representative Norris.
Mr. Chair, I need to point out that that was not a mandate on the school districts. They had the option to levy if they wanted to. So if they wanted the extra money, it was a local decision made by the school board that the legislature gave them. And so we all talk about local control and so forth, and if your school district raised to the max, that was their decision to do that. So I just wanted, for the record, to clarify that.
I want to weigh in on this one. Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, sir.
I actually have a question.
Go ahead, Representative.
Okay. Looking at the bill in front of us here, my question, I guess, we've actually had a surplus in the current biennium in the state grant program. I want to know what this does to the state grant program as far as, you know, you talked about a certain amount of money that you mentioned it's required. So you're suggesting that we raise the amount of money in the state grant program with this, or does it stay within the current budget and then prorate if we run out of money?
Representative Atkins, do you want Mr. Berg to explain exactly what that lowering of those six...
No, I want to do it myself, Mr. Chair.
Well, you've actually done your homework. I'm impressed.
See how much I've screwed up. Mr.
Okay, go ahead. Representative Atkins.
It does both, Mr. Chair, Representative Nornis. It both increases the amount and it increases the eligibility, heightening the or increasing the amount that would be available, based pegging it on the University of Minnesota tuition.
Mr. Chair, could I add to that?
Mr. Mayor?
We would also encourage that whatever adjustments you make here, take advantage of both the surplus that has been in the program, not allow that to seep out, and also to spend the portion that's released by the Pell increases, which Susan Hegart and her staff have just explained to you, spend that on these priorities.
Representative,
and the net cost would probably be less than the fiscal note on this once you did both of those things. But in presenting the bill, we thought the honest way to present this was to represent what the total cost of each of these changes would be by itself.
And we have the fiscal note from the Department of Finance. So Representative Briner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I won't take long on this, but the tax issue obviously draws a lot of interest. And I would just say that those who have expressed support for raising resources need to go back and talk to their communities about that support and speak publicly about it and not rely on the legislature to carry that burden alone. And the idea, I visited with my chamber people yesterday too and was quite open about this. They wore buttons that said, squeeze the surplus, not the taxpayer. If we look at the needs that have come just before this committee, there would be no surplus. So if you're expecting us to look at the student aid proposal and address it fully, you better be honest about what money's on the table.
Thank you. If there are no further questions, then House File 1142 is been laid on the table for possible inclusion. Representative Portman, would you like to take House File 1484 because we might be able to finish that?
Members, thank you.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
Yes, please. And Representative Portman moves that House File 1484 be recommended to pass and held over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Representative Moe, I don't think we're going to be able to get to your bill today. Perhaps, and Representative Nornis will move it to Thursday night. Representative Hartman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm presenting this bill on behalf of Representative Dietrich, who's tied up in the K-12 Education Committee. Representative Dietrich has introduced this bill, which I support and I'm a co-author of, to propose that students, when they're enrolling, should be offered a course in financial management. We've heard from the students about their financial situation, the massive debt that they're undertaking. I'm sure many members of the committee recall when we asked some of these students about the interest rates they were paying and the different loans that they had. It was a struggle for them to even understand what was the total lifetime cost of some of the debt that they were incurring. And so Representative Dietrich's proposal would require that there be some information and skills training in personal financial management. And the only fact that I'd throw out there in support of this proposal is, for the first time since the Great Depression, we have a negative savings rate in this country. And that's a complicated problem. That's a big problem. This is one way at starting to get at that problem.
Representative Hartman, do you intend to have the institutions just eat the cost of this, since there's no fiscal note? Or
Mr. Chair, I am not certain as to Representative Dietrich's intent on that, but that would be my presumption.
Okay, questions? If not, I would like to announce then, Representative Nornes and Moe, that we'll hear your bill next Thursday night. Is it Thursday night? Next Thursday night. Representative Briner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Let me just ask you, the wording of the bill, I believe, is a little bit confusing, because in 1-8 it says the University of, it's Minnesota's, it's, one is required and one is requested. All right, that's, you mentioned a course, but this actually just says training. So it could be, the way I read this bill, it could be integrated into existing courses that a student might take. A math course or basic skills course of some sort, social, is that correct?
That's correct. At lines 1.11 and 1.12, it makes clear if the student would be taking something like economics or some sort of consumer-type credit class. And I think that the language that Representative Dietrich chose about information and skills training in line 1.9 provides a great deal of flexibility to the higher education institutions of whether this is a one-hour seminar that's offered by the financial aid staff or whether it's a course.
Okay, so 1484 is laid over possible inclusion, and the minutes
Chair.
Need to be approved. Representative Slocum, would you move the minutes of the 27th meeting and March 14th meeting?
So moved.
Thank you. Representative Slocum moves the minutes. Are there any additions or corrections? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Members, I apologize to the students and the textbook members who came down here and came all this way. I apologize. The session went over today about a half an hour, and I promise that you will be on the agenda first next Thursday evening. With that, members, excuse me, next Thursday evening, meeting adjourned.